is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, April 20th, 2020. Producing the podcast from his home studio in Connecticut, Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney in my home studio in New York. And before we get going today, this is we had Hall of Famer week last week. This week is General Manager week, and we're going to be hearing from Hall of Fame GM Pat Gillick. Taylor, I was going to say, we've gotten so much great feedback with these long form interviews and storytelling that we've done. And, you know, I know you, every time I get one of those notes, whether it's on Twitter or emails, I really appreciate it. I know you do too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've been getting tons of great messages on Twitter. People just, you know, going about their daily lives looking for a little something to fill the void. And we certainly appreciate all the nice things that are being written in. I have friends and family members who I've said this a million times, but people who have never listened to the podcast before, have never listened to a podcast before, and they get back to me and they're like, oh, wow, those are really good. My wife's boss, he really loved the Davey Martinez one. He sent her a nice note, really, complimenting the show. So, all these folks who haven't been under the tent before, we're opening the doors, continue to think about that as we roll through these interviews. We got some big ones lined up for this week and next. So, lots of exciting stuff going on.
Yeah. It's been really cool with our interview subjects. You know, I explained the emails when I put in the request that, hey, you know, this is a time where, you know, baseball fans are starved for content and we could all use a distraction. And every person who's come on to do these interviews has completely embraced that and been open to telling stories from their careers. And that'll continue today when we talk with Pat Gillick, who discusses the initial concern over Ichiro when he arrived in the big leagues, how some of his biggest deals went down, including the Roberto Alomar blockbuster that shocked the baseball world. And Pat's interesting idea to keep Alex Rodriguez from free agency after the 2000 season. But first, some news and notes. Yasiel Puig says he has multiple offers, but does not expect there to be a 2020 season. Puig recently did an interview with Jorge Ebro of El Nuevo Herald, during which he acknowledged that the Miami Marlins are one of several teams to make him offers, but he still is doubtful that there's going to be any baseball in 2020. The Japan's baseball league was delayed again. There's no date set for a start. Now, there are plans to resume baseball in South Korea. The KBO, the Korea Baseball Organization, will begin exhibition games and begin its regular season as early as May 1st. And people have been asking, hey, if they're playing baseball in South Korea, how close are we to playing, having Major League Baseball here? Some numbers for the sake of context. The U.S. is about 6.5 times larger than South Korea in terms of population. South Korea is a population of about 51 million. The U.S. daily rate of new infections in April is about 300 times greater than that of South Korea for this month, day to day. So it doesn't seem like Major League Baseball is nearly in the same place that the KBO is in terms of making that decision about whether to come back. Now, before we get to Sarah Langs and Pat Gillick, I'm sure you don't need any reminding, but you've got to check out The Last Dance, a behind-the-scenes look at the 90s Chicago Bulls dynasty. The series continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. And listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast, presented by State Farm and AT&T, available wherever you enjoy your podcasts. And Taylor, you said to me the other day, didn't think I was really anything but you just guessed. I wasn't anything but a baseball guy. Do you know that I was at the first Michael Jordan retirement press conference?
Oh.
I covered that for the San Diego Union Tribune.
I did not.
If you go back, I can tell you exactly where I was sitting. It was the first NBA story I'd ever done. I was in Chicago for a Padres and Cubs game, and so I went over and covered that press conference.
They just, I feel like that's a different time. This is probably one of the biggest press conferences in sports, and they let you just waltz on in there. No big deal.
Well, no. San Diego Union, yeah, the Union Tribune actually covered the NBA. And so I got a press pass and went over there. And I was there. I remember just being blown away at how big that was.
I watched both episodes last night. I grew up, in the Washington DC area. So my Jordan memories are him on the Wizards, which, really don't do it for me. So it's cool to go back and see all this old footage, you know, having Michael Jordan himself, you know, tell some stories and talk about, you know, what really is an infamous season. It's pretty wild stuff. I was glued to the television, and I will certainly be back, next Sunday night at 9:00.
numbers game.
Sarah Lang's a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, I reached out to you over the weekend after, you know, I talked to Pat Gillick about that blockbuster trade that he executed back in the 90s when he was general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. And I remember, you know, at that time around baseball, what a big deal it was. Fred McGriff and Tony Fernandez going to the Padres for Joe Carter, slugging outfielder, of course, and Roberto Alomar. We went through that. So I just had an idea over the weekend. You know, I wonder for career war where that would rank among trades. And, of course, you were the person I reached out to with that.
Yeah, that was a really fun question. I spent a lot of time on Baseball Reference this weekend, which is no different than any other weekend or any other day in my life. So starting with that trade to set the scene. So the total amount of career war that was involved in that trade, so not the war that those players had at the time of the trade, but what they ended up with, was 184.5 wins above replacement. Roberto Alomar had 67, Fred McGriff had 52.6, Tony Fernandez 45.3, and Joe Carter 19.6. So already we can tell that that's going to be some sort of benchmark around here. That is a huge number. Anyone can sort of, even without other context, grasp that. So what I did was I looked at every single trade of every single player with at least 67 career war. So Roberto Alomar was the starting point. So there had to be at least a player of his caliber involved in it. Now, obviously, there could have been trades that involved like five players with 50 war, but I just didn't go that deep on the list. We started at 67. And here's the list of the top six trades with the most war but involved in all of those players being traded in the expansion era, so since 1961, involving at least one of those 67 war players. So number one is this 1977 four-team trade involving the Rangers, Pirates, Braves, and Mets, 212.8 war involved in that. Now, it's a four-team trade, so obviously, you know, if you're looking at whatever your context is, maybe we would discount that, but it's so much fun to look at that we're still going to talk about it here. The main player involved here in terms of war was Burt Blyleven with 94.5. And then you've got Al Oliver at 43.7, John Matlack at 39.4. And those are kind of the top players involved in this one.
Yeah. And Sarah, let me tell you this. A 14 trade involving this many players would never happen in 2020 because some of it would leak out and it would all blow up at some point. I don't know how you keep that under wraps. Okay.
It's absolutely incredible to look at just how it looks on the Baseball Reference page. Like there are so many names. There is so much type right there. So number two, 1972 trade between the Dodgers and the Angels accumulated total 208.8 war. Chief player in this one is Frank Robinson, 107.2 career war. And then after that, you've got Andy Messersmith with 40.2. And then Ken McMullen would be the next most in this trade at 34.0. And this is another trade with a lot of players involved.
Yeah. And a couple thoughts on this. I think you would agree with me that this doesn't quite fit some of the other ones because Frank Robinson was well past his prime. He was finishing up his career at this point. And so we did, there wasn't like the prime Frank Robinson involved in this deal. And one other side note, Ken McMullen, you had their 34 war. He was in my first pack of baseball cards that I ever got when I was 8 years old.
Wow. There yep. you go. Love that. So our number three is a 1969 trade between the Twins and the Indians, total of 205.7 war. Main player in this one was Greg Nettles, 68. Next most you have there is Louis Tiant, 66.1. So obviously you've got two right near that 67 I was talking about. Then you have Dean Chance at 29.9.
And one note, and I was just looking this up as you were talking, one of the players, Ted Ulander, was in that trade. And you, of course, know his connection to greatness, right? Besides him?
I'm not sure I do.
His daughter, Katie Ulander, was the American skeleton racer who was in the Olympics 2006, 2010, 2014, 2018.
Wow. That is some significant athletic ability in that family there.
Yep.
Love that. All right. Our number four, 1984 between the A's and the Yankees, 202.8 war. You already know who's going to be involved here. Ricky Henderson, 111.2 career war. And then after that, we've got Jose Rijo, 36.5, and Stan Javier, 25.4. Those are your top three in that one.
Nice. Yeah, Ricky Henderson involved in any trade. He's going to carry that with all of his production.
Exactly. And he was traded a handful of times, and I knew as I was going through his page that at least one of these was going to make the list here. So now our number five, 1999, the Blue Jays and the Yankees, 200.9 WAR, involving Roger Clemens, with 139.2, and David Wells, 53.5, recent podcast guest, of course. Those are your top two. And then you've got Graham Lloyd and Homer Bush with, you know, less than 10 WAR each.
And Sarah, just I was covering the Yankees in the spring of 1999 when that deal went down. Murray Chass, who was my colleague at that time, got a tip that this deal was going to go down. I followed up. We had that story this morning. It was a newsbreaker. And so early that morning, we were all gathered, all the reporters, because of our story, all the reporters covering the Yankees were gathered outside the clubhouse, waiting for David and others to arrive because the deal hadn't been announced yet. And David came strolling into the clubhouse a little bit later than a lot of his teammates. And I remember him looking at us quizzically like, what are you guys doing? And then he immediately, and as we learned later, we didn't see this with our own eyes, he went to his locker and he was summoned into Joe Torre's office. And Sarah, you talk about someone devastated about a trade because David loved being on the Yankees.
Jeez, I can't even imagine, you know, with the way news travels now and everything else, you figure that this day and age, someone would have seen a tweet. He might have heard something. Someone would have whispered something. So really incredible that moment of him actually being like, what are you guys doing here? Like, what's going on? That's
exactly.
Really cool. You know, you don't get that anymore. It just doesn't happen. All right. And then number six on our list is what we already talked about, this Roberto Alomar, Fred McGriff, Tony Fernandez trade. So I already mentioned the numbers there, but it's 1990, Padres and the Blue Jays, 184.5 WAR with Roberto Alomar at 67 leading the way.
And looking at your list, I just noticed this. It's the only deal where you get three different players with at least 45 WAR in their career. That tells you how big of a deal it was among these. And it is, you'll hear in the interview with Pat, yeah, he agrees with me. Like the idea that Roberto Alomar didn't get voted into the Hall of Fame in his first try was staggering and just a shock because of how he changed the way middle infielders play.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely outstanding player. And I don't know. It's always so incredible to me to see these great players having been traded. Obviously the Frank Robinson trade, as you said, end of his career, but he was traded prior to that in his career as well. And, you know, you think about how much it takes for us to finally see someone like Mookie Betts traded these days. And, you know, how many times we heard about Manny Ramirez, is he going to be traded even, you know, more than 10 years ago now. And it's so interesting to me to see these trades because all of these that we talked about, I mean, the latest one was 1999, what you were talking about with Roger Clemens and David Wells. And it feels like these things sort of happen differently. Now we still get blockbusters, but not quite the same and not this caliber of player getting traded.
No, I kind of wondered if the Tom Seaver trade might come close to being involved in this. We talked about that with Johnny Bench last week, and that at the time it went down was huge. And by the way, you mentioned the Manny Ramirez trade. We're going to be talking later in the week with Jed Hoyer, who was formerly with the Red Sox, now with Chicago Cubs, about that deal and how that went down. And also, of course, the trade deadline of 2004 when the Red Sox made that shocking trade of Nomar Garciaparra. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Pat Gillick was inducted into Baseball's Hall of Fame in 2011 after a career of overseeing the Blue Jays, the Orioles, the Mariners, the Phillies. Pat, thanks for joining us and helping to distract us in these times and join in the storytelling.
Well, Buster, it's nice to be with you and the other fans of baseball. I think everybody's looking for something to do with sports, and I think we're all missing the game tremendously at this moment.
Absolutely. And we've had so much fun, you know, talking with folks like George Brett and Mike Messina and Johnny Bench and getting stories from their time in baseball. So, you know, having known you when I covered the Orioles back in the mid 90s, I know you've got a lot of stories from your days in baseball. I wanted to ask you about the spring of 2001 when a Hall of Famer, so we didn't know it at that time, arrived in Mariners camp when you were overseeing Seattle. That was the first spring training of Ichiro Suzuki with the Mariners. And I remember, because I was covering the Yankees at the time, I just remember hearing from scouts stories of, hey, this guy's overrated. He's this little guy. He's got a funky swing. And the initial reaction to Ichiro when he arrived in Mariners camp, looking back on it, seems pretty funny.
Well, I sort of had a little bit of a jump start on spring training right after we signed him. Naturally, it happened at the general manager's meeting that year was in Amelia Island down in Florida. And he came over right after we signed him, and he wanted to take some batting practice at Safeco Field, which is now T-Mobile Field in Seattle. He wanted to take some BP. So one of our coaches who lived in the area, he came over, and he was going to throw a batting practice, and we had a lot of the press out there. And this was in late November, and He stepped into the batting cage and he took 150 swings and never stepped out of the batter's box in 150 swings. He never stepped out to take a deep breath. He never stepped out because he thought he was tired. He took 150 consecutive swings in the batting cage. And so I kind of got a little bit of an advance on what kind of guy he was. And this was a very goal-oriented, a real driven individual. So I knew that, at least from what I saw in that brief work out there in Seattle, that we were going to get a player that was going to be tremendously committed to being not only a great offensive player, but a great defensive player.
Did you have, Pat, some of the concerns initially that I heard from scouts with other teams where they were like, boy, he doesn't really hit the ball. He doesn't really drive the ball. I think just because his swing was so unusual and it wasn't something that people were used to seeing, that they focused on that a lot early in his time with the Mariners.
Well, you know, it's funny. I know it's a different sport, but I always kind of compared him to Wayne Gretzky. It seemed like, you know, Wayne Gretzky didn't have the hardest shot in the world, but it seemed like Wayne Gretzky had the ability to guide the puck into the net. And it's almost like when I first saw him in 2001 and we started playing, you thought it was luck that he was hitting balls continually into the hole between third and short. But as it went on, you knew that this was a design. It was something that he had practiced, something that he had worked on for a long time. And the other thing that we had an advantage, Buster, was former big league manager, a big league pitcher, Jim Colburn was our scout, and he coached 2 years in Japan with Ichiro's team, which was the Oryx Blue Wave. And so he knew him from a makeup standpoint. Jim was bilingual in both Japanese and English, and so he had a relationship with Ichiro, and then he scouted for the Mariners, and he was really the one who put us on to Ichiro and really gave us an advantage, I think, over the other teams at that time.
I saw you and the Mariners in late April of 2001 after he got off to a good start, and you actually were the one who came over to me by the batting cage, and we were talking about, you know, the question whether or not he could drive the ball, and you said, in batting practice, he could hit a ton of home runs. And you mentioned that right away. You were like, yeah, he could do that if he wanted to, kind of like the stories we heard about Wade Boggs.
Very similar to Wade Boggs, because we were in spring training in 2001, and Lou wanted to see him have a little more power. And so Jim Colburn happened to be in Arizona with us, and he mentioned to Ichiro, and in batting practice, he had about 10 balls in a row out of right field in Peoria. And then in a couple of ball games, exhibitions games that spring, he had a couple of home runs. So when he wanted to, you know, he could show you some power, but most of the time he's a contact hitter, didn't want to strike out, wanted to put the ball in play. They have a drill in Japan which is a little bit unique. They throw a pitch and they hit. Bounce it at 58 feet, about 2 feet in front of the plate. And then the hitter is supposed to hit the ball on the bounce after when it comes up on the bounce. And this is a drill that he went through with pitchers throwing the ball 58 feet, and then he would hit the ball off the bounce.
Which helped to explain, you know, how he honed that incredible eye-hand coordination. I really feel like the moment that he arrived, Pat, in sort of a national conscience, at least among people in baseball, was when you guys were playing in Oakland in about he was about 10 days into the big leagues, and Terrence Long was trying to run from first to third base, and Ichiro charged a base hit to right field and made an absolutely perfect throw to third base. In fact, David Bell, you know, if you look at a replay of it, it looks almost looks like the throw would have hit the third base bag if not for the fact that David Bell caught it to tag out Terrence Long. What do you remember about that play?
Well, you know what? I compared that play because I was a kid myself, you know, a long time ago. And the two guys that I thought that could have made that same play, one was Colavito and the other was Al Kaline. If anybody could have duplicated that throw, it would, in my estimation, those were two that it was possible to do it. You don't see plays like that very much anymore. One of the things, you know, as knowing the game, the outfielders are not throwing as well as they did years ago. And I think that's one of the more exciting plays in baseball is to throw a runner out third base, to throw a runner out at home plate. It's a great defensive play. And so, you know, I would rate that throw that he made in Oakland, you know, right up there with some throws that I saw that, as I said, two ex-major leaguer, Colavito and Kaline, made.
Now, you were in the middle of one of the great blockbuster trades in baseball history when you were with the Blue Jays. You swapped Fred McGriff and Tony Fernandez to the San Diego Padres for Roberto Alomar and Joe Carter. Joe McIlvain was the general manager of the Padres at the time. And I remember, you know, that happened during a winter meetings. And these days, it feels like these trades take 60 years to get done. Everyone breaks down every possible bit of value in every deal. But that trade, if I remember correctly, came together in rather short order.
It did, Buster. It's kind of a funny situation, and people forget about the other trade that we made that same meeting in Chicago. We were meeting at the, I think it was the Hyatt Hotel or the Westin Hotel at the airport in Chicago. And on the Sunday, I believe it was the 2nd of December, we made a trade for Devon White. That really, you know, it wasn't as big a trade as people noted on the Alomar Carter deal, but it was a big trade for us. And the funny thing about it was that I know it was Sunday the 2nd because that evening I was still talking to a free agent at the time that had been with Cincinnati Reds. His career most of the time was with Houston, but he was with Cincinnati for the last month of the 1990 season, Billy Dorn. I was talking to his agent because we were looking to do something at second base. And we were real close to a deal on Sunday night to sign Billy Dorn. So we kind of took a respite after the White deal on Monday, and I started to talk to Joe McIlvain on Tuesday. And it was really just a real casual conversation. And I told Joe I was looking for a right-hand hitter, and I was interested in Carter. And he said, well, I'm looking for a left-hand hitter. He said, I'm interested in McGriff. And I said, well, you know, I'd say, you know, that's not too bad a deal. The only thing is that Carter is 3 years older than McGriff. I said, Freddie's 3 years younger. And I think that if we're going to do something like this, I wouldn't be able to do it one-on-one. What if we expand it? And he said, well, what about Tony Fernandez? And I said, well, what about Roberto Alomar? And we both kind of looked at each other and said, let's think this over. So that was on Tuesday the 4th. And I went back to my people, and they were at the time, they were sort of stunned. And I said to them, well, you know, you have to look at the pieces, how the pieces fit together. And I said, if we got Joe in the outfield and Alomar at second, Nola Root at first, I said, you know, we're probably going to be a better club defensively and offensively. So I called Joe back, and I said, well, let's get together on the 5th. And so we got together on the 5th, and talked for a few minutes, and we both decided, let's do it. We'll do it. So it was a very, brief negotiation. Some of these negotiations can be drug out for a long time, but this one was a very short one where we had a meeting of the minds right away. It was sort of is talent for talent. It wasn't prospect for prospect. It was proven talent for proven talent. And so as it turned out, it was a good deal, I think, for both clubs.
If I remember correctly, the potential for that deal didn't leak out, and it sort of stunned everybody in the baseball world. Just from a general manager's perspective, how troublesome can that be when bits and pieces of trades that are being kicked around, can that be for the process?
It can be very troublesome. And at the time, our PR director was Howard Starkman, and Howard says, well, I'll write up a release. I said, Howard, I just would appreciate it, because you never know what people are hanging around the press room or what people are looking over your shoulder. I said, this is not a deal of unknowns. This is a deal of known players. And as soon as we announced McGriff and Fernandez for Carter and Alomar, I said, they might be surprised, but no one's going to say, well, who's that guy or who's that guy? These are proven players. So we decided not to make a press release. Howard got up at the press conference in Chicago and made the announcement. We made a deal, and then Joe and I answered questions. So this was one deal where there was no leakage whatsoever.
Pat, I know how much you love baseball, and I bet you that there was a part of you that was just so thrilled to get Robbie Alomar in that deal, because he was such a transformative talent. When his name came up for Hall of Fame consideration, I was shocked. And I get it, he had the spitting incident with John Hirschbeck, but I was shocked when he didn't get in on the first time on the ballot, because my thought, my God, he changed the way middle infielders play. And he to me had one of the great imaginations of any players that I ever saw in my life.
Well, I totally agree with you. He was a special player, and I know that, you had the opportunity. We were together in Baltimore. You were working for the Sun, and Kenny Rosenthal was over there. So you got an opportunity to see a player, and that's one thing I kind of miss today in the shifts that are going on, is the tremendous defensive plays that some of the key defensive players made in baseball. And Robbie Alomar could make plays defensively that you would say, I got my money's worth right there seeing that one defensive play. He had some of the greatest instinct and intuition of any player that I've been around. And I was a bit taken back that he wasn't on the first round elected to the HOF.
Another potential deal I want to ask you about. You mentioned this to me at one point, and then last year when I worked with Alex Rodriguez in Sunday Night Baseball, he confirmed this. I was fascinated by it when you told me that Alex became a free agent, of course, leaving the Mariners at the end of the 2000 season. He goes on to sign with the Texas Rangers, 10 years, $252 million. And you mentioned to me at some point that you had an imaginative idea to retain Alex in Seattle, which I know from my conversation with him intrigued him, which was a short-term, very well-paying offer. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's a long time ago, but it's almost 20 years ago, because he was a free agent after the 2000 season. And I can't really recall the particulars of it, but it was a short 3-year deal. And I can't remember exactly, Buster, what the numbers were, but it was a deal that I thought, it was more money per season than he would get on an annual basis, on the contract he signed with the Rangers. But again, it goes back to the fact of guaranteed money and length are pretty important, not only to the agent, but to the player. So consequently, it kind of got dismissed and they went on and took a longer term deal. But it was more money per year over a short period of time.
I think Alex mentioned when we talked about last year, it was like 3 years at 90, for 90 million, like 30 million a year, which would have been a higher average value. But certainly baseball history would have changed if you guys had wound up keeping him after that year. I wanted to ask you the path that you took to becoming a general manager, being inducted to the Hall of Fame, is not a path that you would see very often now. You played in the minor leagues. You were a pitcher, and then you worked in a front office. And now, as Chris Antonetti, the head of baseball ops for the Indians, has told me, like, people who would have his resume now wouldn't even be considered because you have all these Ivy League guys who are getting opportunities. What when you think of your path compared to what you see in the game now, what do you think?
Well, I wouldn't. You know what? I enjoyed every stop along the way. I started out in 63. Assistant farm director, then I became a scout, then I became a regional supervisor, then I was a scouting director, and then I went to Yankees as a director of scouting and player development, and then I became a GM. So I made the steps along the way, and I think it really helped me because it kind of put me in a position to know what every person at every level goes through. And I think that's something you have to experience in your career. If you're going to prepare yourself for the top job to be the top decision maker, then you have to, I think, go through those steps. I think it's very beneficial. I think it's difficult for somebody to become a general manager and not to experience what I went through. So I wouldn't exchange it for anything in the world. You know what I went through. Today it's a little bit different. It's sort of like there's a line and all of a sudden somebody says, well, I'm in a button line and I want to go to the head of the line. And so some of the GMs now, unfortunately, don't have the experience, you know, that I had. And I think it really at times you can't put in. There's no substitute for experience. So it's a different situation now. It's a different way of doing business. Time marches on. We got to look forward. We can't look back. And so we'll see how successful some of these people are. And if they are successful, then they'll continue. If not, then I think, you know, maybe we'll have a change back and the cycle will change in another direction.
And Pat, you've always loved information. One of my favorite stories to work in relation to what you've done in the past was on John Olerud. How you assigned Don Welke, one of your scouts, basically to watch John Olerud when he was in college to see all of his at-bats because there had been some physical concerns from an aneurysm that he'd had before. So you value information, but in light of that, how do you feel like is the best possible mix of the analytics we're seeing today and maybe the scout's gut feel for things?
I think there definitely, Buster, has to be a blend. I don't think you can be one way or the other. I don't think you can be completely, as you might say, old school, and I don't think you can be completely new school. I think there's a blend. I think there's information to be gathered not only from R&D, but there's information to be valued by personal observation and evaluation. The thing that a lot of people miss is there is not a lot of difference between a guy's physical ability at AAA and someone else's in the big leagues. The difference to me is there's two things. It's the heart and the head. It's the mental part of the game that is more important than anything. And that is the thing that keeps players from reaching their potential or being big leaguers. It's their heart and it's their head. And I think that is more important than almost the physical ability. When I got into scouting, I thought physical ability was 80% of the game and the mental part was 20. I would say now, in my estimation, it's 70% mental and 30% physical.
Give me an example of a player who, on the positive side, you felt like mentally was better, put himself in that position of being a big leaguer because he was so strong on the mental side.
Well, you know, a guy, and I never had him as a player, but since I've gone into the Hall of Fame, it's amazing how many people that you meet at the Hall of Fame that are in the Hall of Fame where you know that the mental aspect is the reason they've been successful. Tom Seaver is a perfect example. I mean, Tom Seaver just is so much the mental part of the game. You look at Roy Halladay, his game was a very mental part of the game. We had a guy that could not throw 85 miles an hour who won over 260 games, Jamie Moyer. That was the mental part of the game. So it's very, very important that you have the right outlook, that you are driven, that you are persistent. These are all things, all traits you need, and you need the heart and you need the aggressiveness to be a player.
All right, before you go, I want to go rapid fire with you and get scouting reports on some of your peers, other general managers, just in terms of their style of dealing and what they were like to talk trade with. We'll start with Sandy Alderson, who I think someday may also wind up making a speech in Cooperstown.
A very straight shooter, very much to the point. Sandy, if he had a trade in his mind, he was not particularly flexible. He's a little bit stiff about and knew exactly what he wanted. But he was a guy that you could always count on, to be honest, to be upfront with you, and someone that I enjoyed, making a deal with.
The late, great Kevin Towers.
I tell you what, he and I were in some ways were a lot alike. Again, a very open guy. If you ask him a question about his player, he was straight with you too. I enjoyed making deals with Kevin. He was always such a good personality. We'd have a conversation. He'd pop a couple of jokes and get us kind of loosened up. And it was fun to work with Kevin.
Yeah, and you guys had very similar backgrounds coming up into your role of general manager, former pitchers, working in front offices in various capacities before ascending. Brian Cashman, who's currently the general manager of the Yankees.
Again, another guy I enjoyed working with, was with the Phillies, and Brian was right down the road at Tampa, and we were over in Clearwater. So, somebody you could count on their word. If you shook hands on a deal, it was a deal. No ifs, ands, or buts. And somebody that if you came back to him, because my philosophy was, we want to make a deal that's good for both clubs, because I want to do repeat business with this club if I can in the future. So if it works out that when someone gets a better part of the deal than the other, I don't want to really do a lopsided deal. I want to do a deal that I think benefits both of us so we can work together in the future.
Brian Sabian, who ran the Giants, and I think if I remember correctly, you worked with him at the Yankees at one point.
Yeah, he was there for a short period of time. I think Brian, just not to say much about trading with him, we never did much business with Brian. But as far as putting the club together and putting the pieces together, I think he and Bruce Bochy and the other people over at San Francisco did a terrific job. If you look at the talent they had and the way that he pieced those clubs together, he and Bruce Bochy, he did a terrific job. So, and again, Brian was a guy that you could count on. If you called and asked a question, you knew you were going to get a straight answer.
And last one, Billy Bean, of course, is still oversees baseball ops for the Athletics.
I like Billy a lot. It's funny, and I guess in the book Moneyball, I think it has a few pages in there. When I worked him out, he was a high school player in San Diego, and he ended up signing with my good friend Roger Youngward, who has since passed away. But Billy, again, he's a guy you could count on. Straight shooter. Evaluated his players a little bit different than we did because he was more R&D than we were, as I said, visual observation. But again, somebody you enjoyed to work with and you had confidence that whatever he told you, was the truth.
All right, Pat. Well, it was great talk with you. And the other day when I reached out to you for the first time, not surprisingly, because you have a reputation is remembering every phone number you've ever dialed in your life, you double checked and you remembered my phone number from probably last time we talked to you 5-6 years ago.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's good to talk to you. It's nice to talk to the fans. And what I wanted to say is stay healthy and we're going to get through this thing.
Here's Tim Kirkchin's Daily Baseball Fix.
Hi, this is Tim Kirkchin, and on this date in 1908, Henry Chadwick died. He is known as the father of baseball. He is credited with so many things in the game, including the creation of the box score. Box scores are my favorite things in the world. My favorite part of every day is to get up real early, look at all the box scores while I drink a Diet Mountain Dew. There's no telling what you might see in a box score. Years ago, catcher Ben Petrick had a batting line, 3-0-0-4. Three at bats, no hits, four RBIs. He told me, I didn't think I had a very good game. Then I looked at the box score and said, hey, I had a pretty good game. And every day, I check every box score to see if anyone has what I call a reverse triple-double. That is two errors, two strikeouts, and two grounded into double plays in one game. And since GIDPs became official, the only player that's ever done that was Kurt Bavakwa in 1978. I love box scores so much. For a 20-year period from 1990 to 2010, I cut out every box score and taped them into my box score book like I was 7 years old. And a few years ago, Christopher Black, a friend of mine, sent me this box score, the famous 30-3 game between the Orioles and the Rangers. It sits in my office. I look at it every single day. So thank you, Christopher Black, and thank you, Henry Chadwick.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Bleacher Tweets for Monday. First up, Carlos Munez at Carlos Almighty. He writes in, Jim Palmer mentioned pictures being taken with the opposing starter before games. Should Major League Baseball bring this back to advertise matchups the way boxing does? Could be used to inject more rivalry and emphasis on the starters.
Yeah, Noah Syndergaard staring down Madison Bumgarner. That would be pretty cool. But look, the starting pitchers have been de-emphasized in recent years. And the other thing, too, is that more and more teams hide the information about who their starting pitcher is going to be ahead of time. So I think it'd be harder to work. But I like the idea. I like the thought process.
Yeah, that could be fun. Ryan Lounsbury at Rylo21 writes in, with continued advancement in analytics and the quote unquote thought managers are not as important, could you see the player manager role making a comeback, especially in a more cost efficiency effort due to COVID?
I don't know. The one thing I'd say about this, I think managers spend a lot more time at the park than they used to. It's a it is a labor intensive job. Now, it doesn't have the responsibility that you used to have in terms of who's, you know, the power of the manager to make decisions for the organization. But in terms of the time, I don't think that would be workable unless the player you're talking about would be a pinch hitter, you know, DH type at the end of their careers, kind of like the way Frank Robinson was as he took over as manager of the Cleveland Indians.
Last tweet for today, and this is another tweet that came in, and I'm like, oh, I'm excited to hear from Buster on this, the legend of Buster Olney, as I continue to learn about each and every day. Brian Simpson writes in, I read an article that you had a run-in with Deion Sanders when he was a minor leaguer and you were a reporter in Nashville. What is that all about?
Yeah, and Brian, if you want, if you were to Google my name and Deion Sanders, then you would find an article I wrote for ESPN.com, and we actually used it to sort of start spring training every year for about a period of 10 straight years. It was like a kickoff story at the beginning of spring training. Deion, I wrote a column that was critical of the way he was going about his business when he was with the Columbus Clippers. You know, I went to the clubhouse, tried to talk to him. He had no interest in talking with me. And so I wrote this column that was critical. And the next day, as I wrote in the piece, a ball boy, bat boy, brought a baseball up to the press box. And on it were the words, if you write like that your whole life, you'll always be a loser.
Oh my God.
I still have that baseball. Unfortunately, he didn't sign it.
Oh man, that's amazing.
I would at some point, I really do hope, I've never talked to Deion about this. I don't know him. I would love to have a conversation with him. He probably doesn't even remember it because he dealt with a lot of media members through his time, but I'm sure that he would get a laugh out of it the way that I get a laugh out of it.
That is a truly legendary story there, Buster. Thanks.
All right.
Real quick, keep writing in nice things about the podcast. If you enjoy it, let us know. Leave a review in Apple Podcasts. All that stuff is much appreciated.
And that's it for today. My thanks to Sarah Langs and to Pat Gillick and to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.